This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today with efforts in Massachusetts to reform the criminal justice system, part of a nationwide push away from the tough-on-crime approach of the 1980s and 1990s. Today, states from Massachusetts to Texas are reevaluating policies that have caused prison populations to swell to historic levels.
Just this week, Massachusetts officials are asking for a Justice Department-funded top-to-bottom review of the state's criminal justice policies, from early release programs to substance abuse counseling to post-release supervision. The hope is to reduce incarceration costs and bring down the state's recidivism rate, which has remained at about 40% for a number of years.
In a display of political unity, Governor Charlie Baker, House Speaker Robert DeLeo, Senate President Stan Rosenberg, and Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz requested the review. It will be carried out by something called the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, funded by the Justice Department and the Pew Center on the States. We spoke earlier to Senate President Stan Rosenberg about the review.
We need to identify the things we're doing well and the things where we have room for improvement. They look at the whole system from incarceration through reentry and then recidivism and then what happens with people if they do find themselves coming back in through the front door, and why do they end up coming back in through the front door? Have they committed another crime? Have they violated probation?
And let me ask you about that, if I could, Senator, and that is the challenge around recidivism, because in the letter that you, Governor Baker, Speaker DeLeo, and Chief Justice Ralph Gantz wrote to the Justice Department, you point out that there's sort of a good news, bad news story with Massachusetts. The state has experienced an overall decline in the prison population in recent years, but along with that, the recidivism rate has stayed more or less the same, very stubborn at around 39-40%. What do you think explains that?
That's the whole point of the research, is we won't have to guess. They're going to be able to explain to us very clearly and then give us suggestions as to how we can fix it.
Yeah. But you don't have any gut feelings about policies that might make sense that you would imagine would come out of this review?
I can't speak to what might be causing reentry into the system. What I can tell you is some of the things we've heard that relate to reentry into society, which has to do with lack of job training, not being able to get a driver's license, thereby restricting people's capacity to get back to work. A lot of people in our prison system have some form of substance abuse problem, and when they reenter society, if they go back into the same situation they came from, they're likely to have a recurrence. And so trying to figure out how to get them into a situation that is different than the situation they were living in prior to incarceration will make a huge difference. So we know some of the things that are working in other states. What we don't know yet is what are the specific patterns based on our policies, our laws, our regulations, the way things operate in Massachusetts that might unwittingly be contributing to the higher recidivism rate than we'd like.
Let me ask you just about one more area where folks haven't always been in agreement, and this is around the issue of mandatory minimum sentencing. Chief Justice Gantz has called for the elimination of mandatory minimums because, among other things, he says they disproportionately affect minorities. The state's district attorneys, on the other hand, have argued that mandatory minimums are what have contributed to relatively low crime rates. What's your view on this?
I think that there is some more room to work on mandatory minimums. We actually did some change in mandatory minimums about 18 to 24 months ago. It's resulting in starting to reduce the prison population. So when the governor shows the data and says we're among the lowest in the country in terms of the number of incarcerated, that's in part because we've already started to change mandatory minimums. I think there's some more room, but this is careful surgery. This isn't taking a machete to the situation, but I do think that there's still some room.
Yeah. Why now? Why is this a good time to take on this review?
It's never a bad time to take a look at what you're doing and figuring out how to improve it. We spent 30 years being tough on crime in America, and the last 7 or 8 years, with the help of the U.S. Department of Justice and the Pew Center and others, Council of State Governments, we are starting to take a look at a different paradigm, being smart on crime as well as tough on crime, because the states are struggling meeting their budgetary needs, and we're finding that the budgets for criminal justice are growing, and no one was paying attention to whether the policies we were putting in place were working. When people started to look, they saw cracks in the system. They saw huge amounts of money being wasted. Texas was the first state, and it's an amazing story. That was a lock 'em up, throw away the key state, as you know. And they ended up, when they did this review, they ended up canceling the construction of 3 new prisons, closed 2 existing prisons, transferred $450 million out of their prison and jail budget, and took half of that amount, about $220 million, and put it into treatment for those with substance abuse and mental illness, and some have both, and found a dramatic improvement in how they were spending their money and a dramatic improvement in the outcome.
Yeah, really interesting the way this pendulum seems to be swinging back, as you suggested, away from this tough-on-crime approach. But I'm wondering, and this is a sort of big and difficult question, but how do you make sure that it doesn't swing too far the other way as we look for a sort of alternative route, I guess?
That's the job of the administration and the legislature, to find the proper balance. And when states like Texas and Mississippi and Arkansas, which are red states with very, very hard-edged policies and tone on this, can find the balance, we know that Massachusetts and other New England states can as well.
Yeah. And, Senator, how significant is it that all 4 branches of government, the House, the Senate, the governor's office, and the SJC, are all involved in this effort right now?
It took us 7 years to get to this point. I'm ecstatic. We started talking about this in the second year of the Patrick administration. It took until the last 2 years of the Patrick administration for them to recognize the opportunity as a result of putting together a commission. That commission started working on pulling together some progress at the end of the Patrick administration, and the governor hasn't let down. He's keeping that ball rolling forward. And now with the help of CSG, we're going to be able to find some additional things that we may not be aware of that are happening that we could make better fairly quickly and improve our outcomes.
Stan Rosenberg is president of the Massachusetts State Senate. Thank you, Senator.
Happy to be with you. Take care.
The most recent numbers suggest that in 2014, there were more than 11,000 people in jail in Massachusetts. Now, that number has declined in recent years, but as we just heard, the number of people who reoffend is about staying the same. So will this type of review help figure out how to address that? Listeners, we want to hear from you. What is the best way to reform the Massachusetts criminal justice system? Why does it appear that the recidivism rate in the state is remaining stagnant? And would greater supervision of released inmates help? Or would we just wind up sending more people to jail? Let us know your thoughts or your experiences with the criminal justice system by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us in the studio is Rachel Corey. She's director of the Criminal Justice Policy Coalition in Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also on the line with us is Kevin Burke. He's former Massachusetts Public Safety Secretary, and he's chair of the Criminal Justice Department at Endicott College. Hello. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, Rachel, I'm going to start with you. We just heard from Senate President Rosenberg about this letter that he and other state officials signed on to asking for this review. This outside analysis of the system. And we also heard from Governor Baker earlier today. He spoke at the State House about this review and why he wants it. And he also cited the state recidivism rate. Let's listen to what he had to say.
But we do have a 40 to 50% recidivism rate. And obviously, if we can figure out which programs and which approaches seem to work best to reduce recidivism, we'll reduce the population by doing that. Because the big issue is people sort of cycling in, cycling out, cycling in, cycling out.
And Rachel Corey, I'm wondering, is that one of the biggest issues? And what are your thoughts about this review?
So reentry is definitely an important issue. And so seeing that highlighted in this is great, but there's a lot of other issues in terms of pre-incarceration and preventative measures that I think also should be looked at just as strongly.
Mm-hmm. So reentry is a big issue because why? Because there's not enough done while people are incarcerated to make sure they're prepared to get out, or there's not enough supervision when they get out. What's the problem?
Yeah, anecdotally, programs are sparse inside. And then also there's a whole bunch of collateral consequences, such as the driver's license issue happening to folks who are outside, who are getting released. And as we continue to grow our prison population, then we continue to grow the folks who are getting out. Mm-hmm. And so that's important.
So would more supervision once folks are out help?
I don't know if you saw that New York Times article today about a probationer in Maryland, but oftentimes over-supervision can create cycles of reincarceration. And one of my old grad school professors used to say each person commits about 3 felonies a day. So if those folks who are already in the system are being overly supervised, there's a chance that they could just get thrown back in.
I see. And we do know that statistics, certainly from other jails, suggest that many of the people who are incarcerated are there because of probation violations. So what we end up doing sometimes is incarcerating more people by increasing oversight. But at the same time, we have to protect public safety. So how do we do that?
Yeah. So the Justice Reinvestment Initiative is premised on sending the savings of criminal justice back into public safety measures. And I would argue that beyond the regular law enforcement issues and incarceration, what also can be funded is job development and small business development. I think we have a few great programs in this state, such as ROCA or UTEC in Lowell, that really show that job and workforce development can help folks who have had a history of incarceration.
Okay. Kevin Burke, I'd like to ask you, this review apparently that state officials are calling for would provide data that would help inform exactly how best to reform the system. As former state public safety secretary and as a former prosecutor, where do you see the greatest need for reform?
Well, I think the governor touched on it, President Rosenberg touched on it in their remarks. I think reentry is important. We really don't have a coordinated reentry program right now, so I think the data is going to show parts of the system that need improvement. I would disagree a little about the over-supervision of people on the street. I think that what we're talking about there is situations, and this was particularly true in places like Texas, where people were reincarcerated based on small administrative violations. But I think that supervision on the people that are released to the street is essential to any effective reentry program. And supervision means that they get access to health care. They're assisted in obtaining employment. They're able to get housing. All of those things become a critical part of supervision, and supervision really is a matter of coordinating all of our social services so that we respond to people well. So reentry has a lot of moving pieces. It has to be coordinated. The data will help us with that. There are things that haven't been touched on in the general discussion of justice reinvestment, at least so far as I know, but the number of people who are in a pretrial population, how can we limit them? More involvement with sheriffs, coordinating between the Department of Corrections and the sheriff's departments, and stepping down people into the community. What will happen with this program and the research is an analysis of prison classification or inmate classification, so that we're developing an effective reentry program and, again, stepping down people appropriately into the community. This is a very positive development. People have been talking about it for a long time, and this step in the right direction, and we'll, in a year's time or so, see what reforms it will start developing.
Mm, okay. We are asking our listeners to talk about their experiences and their thoughts on this topic. Again, our number here at Radio Boston is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Monica is calling from Fenway. Monica, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an epidemiologist, and I grew up in Minnesota, but I'm here in Boston. And I was appalled. I had a friend who got bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And our mental health system is what would have kept him out of the criminal system. But Arbor Counseling is our mental health system. This conglomerate, which has been known. It's been in the news. Arbor HRI in Brookline. Someone died there.
Okay. Monica, we're not going to badmouth any kind of health care provider. Do you have something to say about incarceration and mental health?
Our mental health system is mostly this organization that people go to. And when I saw it, I worked at the Army. People came back with PTSD. Were trying to use their services. My friend was trying to use their services. They have been in the news, okay? If those services worked, if Arbor worked, or
are you saying, Monica, essentially, I think I get your point. I think what you're saying here is that we're actually incarcerating many people who need mental health services. Thanks very much for the call. I want to ask Kevin Burke about that right now, because this is something, Kevin, that we've heard about several times, that many people are incarcerated because of mental illness and or substance abuse. I believe one of the statistics from Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins is that 70% of the inmates in his jail have substance abuse problems. Would a review like this help address that issue, that criticism that really what our jails have become are de facto mental health institutions?
Well, I think the percentage of the numbers that Sheriff Tompkins talks about are accurate as pertain to Suffolk, and other counties have similar numbers. It's not a question of someone being incarcerated because of mental illness or a mental health issue. It is that that they have that condition. They've committed a crime. When they get to prison, it evidences itself, if it didn't already exist, which speaks to in most cases, people entering the criminal justice systems have had several prior involvements. Why we can't identify early on the mental health issues, apply more community services to those folks, and begin to reduce their issues, which may cause them to commit crime, is I think an important thing for us to look at. But I don't think anybody in the criminal justice business, anybody that's talking about reform today, doesn't recognize there's a serious mental health component to the criminal justice issue, and both pre and post release requires us to make sure any reform involves the mental health system, the social service system in general, to improve it.
Okay, I understand that, but I also, you know, I think we've known about that. I'm wondering how a review like this might help. I mean, isn't it, you know, if we're hearing these numbers from sheriffs and we know that the mental health issue is a big issue in our incarcerated population, then we may have more data to back that up. But do we have the will and the ability, really, to address that problem the way it needs to be addressed?
Well, I think we have the will. The ability sometimes is a question of resources, and if you have people, if they have the entire government supporting this idea of justice reinvestment, they'll get the resources. But remember, the value of the program is to take a look at what's going on in institutions. You know, when we're talking about developing evidence-based practices and best practices, you're going to take that data and say, is there anything that's working there that works well and that we should replicate in other parts of the system? What about on, let's take a look at the population that's being released that are receiving some services. What's what are the level of services? What's the value of those services? There's a whole analysis that comes from the data that's going to help you make some decisions about how you develop and treat people coming out of our criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rachel, I'd like to ask you a question, because we did bring this up in our conversation with Senate President Rosenberg, and that's about mandatory minimum sentences. And that's obviously a hot topic of debate right now here in Massachusetts, where you've got Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Gantz saying we need to eliminate mandatory minimums, and then you've got the district attorneys in the state saying, no, they've helped reduce crime. So there's a real debate. What do we know about mandatory sentences right now? Do they help reduce crime? In a nutshell, and I'm sure there's been a lot of work, a lot of debate about this. I know there has. But in a nutshell, what does the research suggest to us about mandatory minimums?
So long sentences are not a deterrence factor. Again and again, that comes up in research. And so with mandatory minimums, especially for nonviolent drug offenders, which is the debate going on in Massachusetts right now, it's not preventing crime from happening.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, would you agree with that?
Well, I think this is something that is subject to discussion that caused Senator Rosenberg to say that there's a surgical approach when it comes to mandatory minimums. There's, if not a general assumption, some assumption that most people that are being committed under mandatory minimum sentences are people who have not committed violent offenses. And you have to, again, this is where you go through your data and you analyze, well, of those people, what are their prior records? While the committing sentence might be a mandatory minimum drug sentence, are there additional charges that relate to violence? So you have to start with that. I agree with Rachel, and I think pretty much everybody agrees that longer sentences aren't reducing recidivism. How you treat, and I know the DA's argument, I probably posed it myself years ago and it's being posed now, is that they can move bad guys, people that may be drug dealers but otherwise violent, through the system quickly because they have the ability to impose or not impose through charge bargaining a mandatory minimum sentence. But long sentences don't work. So we have to look at that. Let's take a look at that population that are in the minimum mandatory category and figure out who they are and is there a way to identify the right people in terms of punishment. I think in the end you're going to see a reduction of the number of drug sentences that minimum mandatories are applied to. How many, is it a matter of quantity of drugs people that people possess or rating them based on prior convictions? All of those things would be under review, but I think you'll see a reduction in the number of crimes under which you have, in the drug area, mandatory minimum sentence.
I just wanted to pick up on the careful surgery comment, Rosenberg, talked about, because we're very slow when we do criminal justice reform, but when there's something that makes it harsher, the legislature tends to act quickly. And so just trying to balance out the difference between reforms and harsher measures is something that would be great.
Okay, we want to make some room for telephone calls here. So we'd like to go to Bobby, who's calling from Saugus. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Bobby, you're on the air.
Okay, so I had a question. I wanted to know if there was something more along the lines of people who are incarcerated coming back out of incarceration being placed back into the same environment, and that environment being a precursor to allowing them to get back into the same situations that originally got them incarcerated in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe it might not be a lot of the system. It might just be the structures that we're just releasing these individuals back into. And if there is something, if there's a study or if there is some kind of system in place where people are being released into a different environment, and if they're...
If it's any different, if there's a better outcome. Do we know anything about recidivism rates, either Kevin or Rachel? Kevin, let's ask you, do we know anything about recidivism rates if there's a complete changeover for the person involved?
Yeah, what we know is that in Massachusetts, and I can't come up with the exact percentage right now, but a very high percentage, 70% of the population being released from DOC are going back to about 8 communities in the state. Mm-hmm. So that there are a lot of reasons for that. They live there. They have some connection to the community there. I'm not sure that you could change that and put them in some kind of environment that doesn't tempt them. What you have to do is have the kind of services and supervision that when we talk about reentry, that slowly reenters them into community so that they understand the stresses they're going to face. And the other thing that we're talking about, and folks should understand, it's not a zero-sum game. What we're talking about is being able to reduce recidivism. I think Rachel's point is very accurate. When some terrible tragedy occurs, we can move pretty quickly in producing changes to the criminal law particularly. I'm not sure if that's a good idea, and in fact, it usually isn't a good idea. On the other hand, building the system, building a reentry system that allows for people to develop their re-involvement in the community is critical. So you're not going to change the environment to which people are going to be released, but how they're supervised, the opportunities, the re-entry process, if you will, increase with some offenders, increase furlough programs, those kinds of things. And, we're going to reinvest our money. We've got to reinvest it. Couldn't disagree more with people that say that there's going to be more more supervision is bad. I haven't seen the Times article, but generally those kinds of criticisms about probation are the types that talk about administrative violations and people being violated on their probation. The other thing that we don't have and we need immediately, and it's shocking, Governor Patrick filed legislation repeatedly, is we don't have mandatory post-release supervision.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of folks that are coming out of DOC, too many, because they choose, and these are the most dangerous people, to, you know, what folks in DOC would call, and police would call, wrap up. They'll do their whole sentence rather than be subject to parole.
Exactly.
Yeah, so those folks, we have to change that. They're coming out anyways. We have to supervise them.
I think you know, we've done stories about that. I think that was in the Middlesex County Jail at one point. Most of the inmates there said they'd rather stay in jail than be on probation, because what happens with probation, they feel, is that there are so many conditions that they have to meet that they know it's impossible for them to meet them without cars, without jobs, sometimes without driver's licenses, because, as you know, this debate has been going on in Massachusetts about people who've been convicted on minor drug crimes. They have to pay a fee or lose their license for a certain amount of time. I can't remember the specifics, but it's certainly been a debate to change that here. And it's because those conditions are so onerous for many people that they can't meet them, and they're going to just wind up back in jail. I think that's what the people involved in the system do say.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the sort of the danger of an anecdotal analysis. And what we're going through right now will be a greater look at the data and find out exactly who and how many could be violating. Remember, House of Correction sentences are about less than a year on the average. So,
well, yeah, they can
so
be up for
wrapping,
2.5.
They're not wrapping up, staying in prison, Department of Corrections for years. All those things should be looked at, can be valid criticisms. On the other hand, let's look at all the data. Who's coming out? What conditions of probation are? If the ways to make sure that people are compliant with their conditions of probation can be made easier, if you will, and more sensible, all those things need to be and will be part of the discussion.
Rachel.
Oh, just data is definitely important, but I think we can't overlook anecdotal evidence. The folks who are most affected by this, who have gone through the system, have a lot of knowledge that we need to capitalize on. And that's how this driver's license bill came to be, because quarry reform advocates found out that there was this backdoor quarry available on their driving record.
Backdoor quarry, meaning that someone could look it up and take their license away, or put a fee on, a pretty high fee, right? What's the fee to get?
Yeah, so if you're convicted of any drug offense, uh-huh, whether or not it's related to operating a vehicle, you can lose your license for up to 5 years and have a fee of up to $500 to reinstate it.
And a bill is pending right now that would change that.
Correct.
And Kevin Burke, your thoughts on that?
I think it's a good idea.
Okay. And I just would like to know, we have only about a minute and a half with both of you, so I'd like just you to sum up here. If you could pick the one thing that you think would really help the criminal justice system in Massachusetts, what is it, Rachel?
Oof. We need to make sure that all this momentum moving forward doesn't just get funneled into one direction. And so while this Pew research goes forward, we also can't overlook all of the legislation that's currently pending this session.
Okay. Kevin Burke?
A coordinated reentry system, including community health services, Department of Corrections, Sheriff's Department, prosecutor's offices, certainly the judiciary in terms of probation. All of those things we need to do a better job at, and I think we will get a very good look at those possibilities at the end of this period.
All right. Kevin Burke, chair of the Criminal Justice Department at Endicott College, former Massachusetts Public Safety Secretary, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rachel Corey is director of the Criminal Justice Policy Coalition. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And stay with us. Coming up, Cambridge cabbies go on strike today to call for more regulation of ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.